Welcome to this audio recording by the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. I'm Jim Falk, President of the Council. We are a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to promoting public awareness of global issues and the ways in which they affect the Dallas-Fort Worth region. Become a member today at dfwworld.org and help us connect North Texas with the world. This podcast is made possible through the generous support of Haynes & Boone, LLP. We hope you enjoy it.
Everyone would agree we're in another scary time in American foreign policy when we have more questions than answers. Tough questions. How do we deal with a new global threat of militant Islamic terrorism? How do we cope with the habitual inability of the United Nations and other international bodies to act on the most urgent and deadly problems? In today's international system, with no true central authority and everyone looking to America for leadership, what is our place and what do we do? Our Iraq experience has caused some people to lose faith in our ability to control our destiny. Many have even withdrawn into isolationist frames of mind. These questions and more would seem to require answers beyond usual back and forth discussions. They require the attention and explanation of people with exceptional expertise. Our speaker here today is one such authority. Indeed, his new book, The American Era, dealing with the very questions I mentioned, has generated unusual reviews from prominent scholars. Robert Kagan says this may be the best book on American foreign policy written since September 11. Michael Mandelbaum wrote, with its powerful thesis and compelling arguments, Robert Lieber's book, The American Era, is destined to become a key text in the global debate about American foreign policy. Fuad Ajami of Johns Hopkins, says it is a book of quality by a scholar of genuine depth and authority. Professor Robert Lieber, a native of Chicago, received his doctorate from Harvard. He is a professor of government and international affairs at Georgetown University. His expertise is American foreign policy and U.S. relations with the Middle East and Europe. Please join me in welcoming Professor Bob Lieber.
Thank you very much, Mel, and thank you to the World Affairs Council and the American Jewish Committee for the invitation to speak to you today. I'm also impressed by the status of the World Affairs Council and your award as the best large chapter in a major national organization. I think it says something about the dynamism and quality of what you've been up to. I want to share with you some thoughts today about America's role in the world, and in doing so, try to rise above what has become a rather unseemly food fight about foreign policy. Whether you look at debates on cable TV over the last 5 years, or the more partisan disagreements about the Iraq War, or political combat about the Bush presidency on the part of supporters and opponents, there's often much more heat than light. Among foreign audiences, I think the situation is even more alarming in terms of the absence of more reasoned discourse and analysis about the great issues of our day and what America's world role is and ought to be. Tony Blair, the British Prime Minister, has commented in his concern about what he describes as, quote, mad anti-Americanism, unquote, among many of the British chattering classes and others. But I think even in the academic world, and after all, I come out of the academic world, there is all too often a tendency for partisanship and the skillfully worded polemic to shade analyses of these problems. I think also that one needs to address these questions about America's world role without becoming so obsessed by the Bush presidency that it monopolizes the entire discussion. Obviously, the Bush presidency is relevant, but my starting point really is the meaning of 9/11 and the kind of world that it is symbolized and signaled that America finds itself in. And it's a world which the next president of the United States on January 20th, 2009, just under 2 years from now, is going to find himself or herself confronting when many of the debates and diatribes look pretty stale. My own assessment rests on three premises. It's the argument of the book and also the argument of what I'm going to have to say here today. My three premises are, first, that in the world of the 21st century, the United States faces a very real, lethal, dangerous, and durable threat. It is a threat that is going to be with us a long time, that is not susceptible to quick fixes or slight changes in policy or indeed changes in policy overall, and that any grand strategy, that is the overall rationale for the ensemble of foreign policy, needs to have this as its foremost concern. I'll elaborate on that point in a minute. The second major premise, it has to do with the weakness of international institutions. In the debate about the wisdom of the war in Iraq in 2002-2003, many of those who counseled restraint or argued against the use of force argued that no use of force could be entered into unless it was authorized by the United Nations Security Council. I suggest to you that that view is ahistorical, and also it tends to assume that the United Nations is more able to do things to deal with the world's most dire, urgent, life and death matters than is in fact the case. I'm going to come back to this point in just a bit. And my third premise has to do with both the existence and importance of American primacy. After all, the title of my talk today is American Primacy, Necessary, Desirable, and Sustainable, I'd also suggest that for those other thoughtful authorities on foreign policy, some of whom you've had here, and some of whom are even my Georgetown colleagues, who look at this question, these questions differently, I suggest to you that that difference ultimately rests on whether or not they regard the international threat environment as truly lethal, long-term, and dangerous. If you take a more relaxed view of that threat, then it's understandable you may have other priorities. So I think that's a fundamental dividing point. There's also a dividing point about what are the causes of jihadism and terrorism, and I'll turn to that momentarily. So let me begin with my first premise, which is the lethality of threat. And by the lethality of threat, I'm really talking about a combination of three different things: jihadism, terrorism, and weapons of mass destruction, or more precisely, chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear weaponry, things capable of causing mass casualties in another 9/11 scale attack. Now, some would say, well, there has not been an attack since 9/11, that there has been a great exaggeration about the nature of threat, that, yes, there are a lot of problems in the Middle East, but that there's altogether too much emphasis on this. Some would argue that it's a deliberate overemphasis by the administration to distract our attention from other legitimate concerns at home and abroad. I respectfully disagree, and to substantiate my point, I will quote both Lee Hamilton and Osama bin Laden. Let me start with Lee Hamilton, whom I respect a lot and got to know when I did a year sabbatical at the Wilson Center in Washington and half a dozen years ago. As you know, Lee Hamilton was the co-chair of the 9/11 Commission, a very respected bipartisan figure, Democrat from Indiana, who, by the way, had a contract to play professional basketball after he graduated from the University of Indiana and instead went to law school. The a year after the 9/11, and he was, of course, co-chair of the 9/11 commission with Governor Tom Keene of New Jersey, and that commission came in with a unanimous report, the 9/11 commission report, which was itself remarkable. The report itself refers to the fact that the 9/11 commission report refers to, quote, the catastrophic threat at this moment in history is Islamist terrorism. A year after the report was delivered, there were some follow-up efforts, and Governor Keene and former Congressman Hamilton gave a press conference at which they said there will be another attack. Well, Lee Hamilton spoke at Georgetown 2 weeks ago, and I asked him, I referred back to those previous references, and I asked him whether it was his judgment in view of the fact that no attack in the last 5 years and so on and so forth, whether he is convinced there will be another major mass casualty attack on the scale of or greater than 9/11. He did not hesitate for a second. He said, and I quote, "I have no doubt," unquote. Now, again, I mention this because there's all, particularly in the political discourse, there's a tendency to sometimes turn this into a partisan question. And I think fundamentally it is not. But let me take Osama bin Laden for my other authority. Osama bin Laden has said it is a sacred duty for al-Qaeda to acquire nuclear weapons. He has said that they would be justified in killing 4 million Americans, half of them children. In fatwas in 1996 and 1998, he declared war on America and urged his followers to kill Americans wherever you can find them. And just for good measure, he threw in the Jews as well. The Senator Richard Lugar, one more authority, the, again, highly regarded, very bipartisan figure, Republican senator from Indiana, was chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee until the Democrats regained control of the Senate in the last elections. He commissioned a staff study in June of 2005. They asked 85 of America and Europe's leading experts on terrorism and proliferation what probability they would assign to the likelihood of a major incident in the next 10 years involving nuclear, radiological, chemical, or biological weapons. The average probability estimate of these experts for 10 years from 05 was 29% estimate of a nuclear attack, 40% radiological, and 70% that somewhere in the world there would be a major chemical, biological, radiological, or nuclear attack. Now, in fairness, this is no more than an educated guess by people who are experts in the field, but not polemicists or partisans. My Georgetown University colleague, Bob Gallucci, who's the dean of our Foreign Service School and a major figure as a leading arms controller in both Republican and Democratic administrations, and who was part of the team in 1991 after the Gulf War that discovered that Saddam Hussein had a workable design, not the weapon, but the design for a gun-type nuclear device. All he needed was a grapefruit-sized lump of highly enriched fissile material to be the explosive core for such a weapon. Gallucci also worries a great deal. In his case, his nightmare is that sometime in the next years, no one can know, a year, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, that there is a risk of a nuclear weapon going off in a container somewhere in an American port. And Gallucci notes that since al-Qaeda and groups like it are fond of doing multiples, they were after four hijacked planes on 9/11. In 1995, there was something called the Bojinka plot that would have involved blowing up between 10 and 12 wide-bodied airliners over the Pacific and so on, that were a terrorist group to have the capacity to do one container nuclear weapon sometime in the future, that there's no reason to think that they wouldn't be attempting to do three or four or five of them at the same time. The problem, of course, is that this is an enormous, very deadly risk, but the probability of it is simply unknowable. I've cited a few things as estimates, but they're really no more than educated guesses. Nonetheless, on this first point about the lethality of threat, I think that if you are taking a broad view about America's world role, about the threats America faces, it is essential to have a very serious prioritization of threat as the single most important factor in shaping or conditioning decisions about American foreign policy. My second point, related, is still within the realm of threat. I said my first part about threat was lethality. The next has to do with jihadism. The need to take radical Islamists seriously. Just because people say and maintain and propagandize things that are nihilistic, conspiratorial, and delusional doesn't mean that these ideas shouldn't be taken seriously. Just because they're irrational doesn't mean they don't have consequences. I would think that given the history of the 20th century, where national leaders have sometimes subscribed to the most fanatical and murderous doctrines and beliefs, Pol Pot, Adolf Hitler, Stalin, and so forth, that when you have figures aspiring to power, or in some cases having certain kinds of power, who say and maintain murderous and fanatical things, we ought not just to wave it off and say, well, they don't really mean it. If they get power, they'll moderate. And if only we feel their pain or make this slight change in policy, that will accommodate them. I don't accept that logic. As the great sociologist Robert Merton said half a century ago, if people believe things are real, they are real in their consequences. And the reality is that there are individuals and movements and groups and terrorist organizations propagandizing, arguing for, and manifesting beliefs that are exceptionally dangerous and are not going to go away anytime soon. There is also a broader point about the spread of more delusional beliefs in certain societies. I would argue with you, to you, and again, this is something that's debated among terrorism experts and strategic experts. Some would say, well, the problem of terrorism is really a problem of occupation. America's occupying Iraq, or Israel is occupying Gaza and the West Bank. And if only these occupations weren't there, then the problem of terrorism would be largely gone. I reject that analysis. I think it's ahistorical. I don't think it really cuts to the core of this. Because in my view, and here I also subscribe or share a lot of what, for my money, the best experts in the field have written, that is people like Fouad Ajami, Bernard Lewis, Olivier Roy, Gilles Kepel, and others, that radical Islamism, jihadism, is driven by a sense of both individual and societal rage, which goes far beyond any particular individual crisis or occupation or conflict. It is a rage caused by the impact of modernity and globalization on Arab Muslim societies, which, with a few exceptions, have not been very successful in adapting to the needs of their own people in the face of these historic transformations. The Arab Human Development Report, written for the United Nations in 2002 by 15 Arab economists, makes something of the same point. They argue that there are three very grave deficits in the modern Arab world today. Again, there are exceptions in some cases, but the gist of it is a very severe deficit in the role and treatment of women in society, in knowledge and information, and in political freedom and liberty. And that these deficits run very deep. The consequence of these deficits is that both at the individual level and the societal level, there's a lot of rage and anger in blocked societies. Most of the countries of the Arab world are dictatorships of more benign and more virulent nature. But almost all of them are very effective mukhabarat societies. Mukhabarat, of course, is the Arab word for the intelligence services. In almost all of those societies, you can get yourself in extremely grave danger if you so much as look cross-eyed at your regime. But if you argue, say, preach, teach, propagandize the most virulent, diabolical things about America, the West, Jews, Christianity, and even moderate Islam, it's a kind of escape valve, and in many of those societies you can get away with it or even encouraged to do it, to take your eye off what is going on. It's also worth noting, in terms of the sense of societal humiliation, that in his 1998 fatwa, Osama bin Laden, which again was a fatwa in which he declared war on America, by the way, at a time then when Bill Clinton was president, feeling everybody's pain, when the U.S. was not in Iraq, and when the Israeli-Palestinian peace process was going swimmingly. Bin Laden referred to 80 years of humiliation, kind of a reaction against it. Well, 80 years of humiliation, for those of you with a more historical bent, represented the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, the final end of the Muslim Caliphate, that is the combined notion of religious and secular rule, which could be traced back to the Prophet Muhammad. Well, 80 years ago was a long time ago when the U.S. was not involved in the Middle East, but once more it says something about the humiliation, societal humiliation, which is then sometimes amplified by very capable, educated engineers, scientists, technocrats, would-be students who go to Europe and encounter a modern world in which they are caught in the middle, betwixt and between, alienated, and sometimes lash out with just fanatical rage. That certainly fits Mohammed Atta, who led the 9/11 hijackers and who was spent a lot of time in Hamburg. Let me say a bit more about the nature of the jihadists, because, again, a lot of this analysis that I'm offering hinges on how grave you think the threat is and what its ultimate causes are. If you think that the causes are susceptible to immediate quick fixes, it's one thing. If you don't, and I don't, it's something else altogether. It's worth noting that terrorist attacks have taken place not just in Baghdad or in the U.S. on 9/11 or in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, for example, but in Istanbul, throughout North Africa, in Amman, Jordan, in Bali, Indonesia, in an attempt to blow up the parliament in India, in a couple of dozen countries around the world, many of which have nothing to do with American foreign policy in one form or another, and suggest something about how deep and underlying this impulse is that has to be combated. You can also look at such other instances as the blowing up of the Golden Dome Mosque in Samarra in Iraq, the a sacred important shrine for the Shiites of Iraq, done by Al-Qaeda Sunni radicals, or an example in Europe of the a murder in broad daylight on a street in Amsterdam and the evisceration of the Dutch playwright and filmmaker Theo van Gogh by a fanatical Islamist who wanted to extirpate everything that this somewhat radical, very secular person stood for, who had criticized radical Islam and its oppression of women. One last item. There was even an incident a couple of years ago where a suicide bomber blew up a group of Afghan Muslim pilgrims gathering to go on the Hajj. So the notion that you can describe this problem of terrorism is rooted mainly in, again, the U.S. and Iraq, the pros and cons of the Bush administration, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, or what have you, I think, is simply not a good way of making sense of it. Also, while I would not say that you can draw a simple analogy, there are ways in which some of the aspects of radical Islamism bear some family resemblance to fascism. The cult of the leader, the love of death, statements like, we love death more than you love life, the oligarchic nature of rule, appeals to the masses, radical conspiracy theories, hatred of Jews, Christians, and even other Muslim sects and minorities, Shiites, for instance. Let me turn to the second premise, which has to do with the limits of international organization. Here I'm tempted to invoke the words of Mahatma Gandhi about three quarters of a century ago when he was asked what he thought about Western civilization. His reply was, "It would be a good idea." Well, it would be a lot better, I suppose, more peaceful, more stable, more orderly, more decent world if the United Nations really could and did meet the objectives of its founders in the UN Charter. That the UN Charter represented something of a functional equivalent of, let's say, the American Constitution, but at a global level. And that when terrible things were happening, the United Nations, through its mechanisms, could stop this from happening and restore order, stop mass killing, and so forth. Tragically, this is not the case. Now, the UN can do many unique and important things. If it did not exist, we would have to reinvent it. The UN has unique virtues and abilities in terms of peacekeeping when there is a peace to keep. Not peacemaking when there is no peace yet. In aspects of economic development, holding elections, acting as an intermediary that opposite sides to a conflict can both accept, and even in representing a certain kind of legitimacy, although at times that representation can be highly hypocritical. One thinks of the travesties of the United Nations Human Rights Commission and its replacement body, the Human Rights Council, which looks to be just about as bad as the Human Rights Commission was, not least because many of the world's most appalling violators of human rights sit on that council. I'm not saying this is a good thing, but I'm simply saying it's a reality. Now, if you think I'm being too harsh about the UN, I will cite the Rwanda genocide, mass murder and ethnic cleansing in Bosnia, the mass killing going on in Darfur now, the failures in southern Lebanon over 25 years. If there were a world in which the UN really had what so many of those who say, well, we've really got to rely more on the UN had in mind, those things would not happen, or at least be greatly reduced. The failures there are both failures of the UN as an organization, but more broadly speak to the realities of the international community. That is to say, we live in a world of states. There are rudimentary areas of cooperation, international law, and so forth, many of them quite important. But on the most urgent life and death, time-sensitive matters, when lives hang in the balance, alas, most of the time, you cannot assume that the UN can do it. Cooperation is highly desirable. The U.S. cannot and should not try to do everything. It cannot be the world's policeman. But the problem is that unless the United States is actively engaged as leader, participant, catalyst, behind-the-scenes mover, funder, whatever, the alternative to American leadership is not that some other country will play this role, but that more often than not, no one will. Which brings me to the third premise of my talk today, the importance of American primacy in the post-9/11 world and the unique U.S. role. Other countries are going to look to the United States for leadership, whether they want to or not. Certainly, although one of my Georgetown colleagues who you've had here before, who's a friend but whom I disagree, has had a much more, how shall I say, imaginative notion of Europe becoming a United States of Europe with a unified military and foreign policy and rapidly moving to counterbalance the United States, I think that analysis exists in a parallel universe. The Europeans I know, the European governments, do not want a rupture with the United States. Europe's national interests, its security, and even shared values with the United States are much too important. And Europe's own incapacity and weakness. Europe is not a United States of Europe of 480 million people. It is 27 countries with enormous accomplishments in many realms, but not in the realm of great power politics and to cope with a lot of the things I've talked about. Europe has an enormously important role to play, but it's not going to be one against the United States. All the same, the U.S. is the world's principal provider of collective goods. For those who are, especially from abroad, but sometimes here in the United States, unhappy about the U.S. throwing its weight around in the world, it's worth noting what would happen if the U.S. were to disengage, and whether if Iraq is a failure, and we're not there yet, it's an open question. But if the U.S. fails in Iraq and completely disengages, not just from Iraq, but pulls back, really withdraws, rather of the sort that happened after Vietnam, let me suggest to you that rather than being a more peaceful, stable world, it is likely to be a more lethal, violent, dangerous, and unstable world in many general and specific points. The Harvard historian Niall Ferguson, some of you may have read some very good best-selling books he's written about international economics and economic history, has warned that those who don't like unipolarity should be wary about apolarity, that is, without a pole. In other words, the absence of any leading powers willing or able or having the ability to help to provide order, organization, and what have you. My friend and colleague in Washington, Michael Mandelbaum, who's at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, wrote a book a few months ago with a title which I think was brilliant. It's called The Case for Goliath. Well, guess who Goliath is? And Mike, in his book, argues that, again, U.S. is the world's principal provider of public goods. And he concludes by saying that three things are certain about this role in terms of how other countries see it. They won't pay for it, they will continue to criticize it, and they will miss it when it is gone. Or I should say, if it is gone. So, there are three premises here. Threat, the weakness of international institutions, that you can't simply say, well, let the UN do it or the European Union do it or whatever, and the unique U.S. role. Well, what does this mean for American grand strategy? By grand strategy, I mean the overall rational or logic for how a country carries out its foreign policy. In World War II, America's grand strategy was total defeat of the Axis powers in war. In the Cold War, America's grand strategy was containment of the Soviet Union. Now, grand strategy doesn't always tell you what your specific policy should be. For example, you could favor containment, as most people did, and yet argue and debate whether we should be in Vietnam or not. But grand strategy is important in shaping how you look at the outside world. Now, I don't want to make a case either for or against Bush foreign policies per se. I'll be glad to pick it up in the question period. But the Bush grand strategy, as enunciated in September 2002 in something called the National Security Strategy Document, has elements which I think are going to prove durable. Whether or not one subscribes to other aspects of the Bush foreign policy, I think it's a reasoned response to the kind of threat environment and the world of post 9/11. There are four main parts to that grand strategy. I think three of them look to me like they're going to prove to be fairly durable. The first one has to do with the importance of maintaining primacy in a dangerous world. I won't elaborate. The second point, highly controversial, argues that the U.S. must have the capacity to preempt, that is, in a nuclear world, in the face of an imminent threat, the U.S. cannot allow itself to be handcuffed and refuse to respond if it believes a threat is imminent. Now, let me add that this is a very tricky proposition because the line between preemption and prevention is never perfectly clear. There are some instances in history in the last century, just a few, in which preemption has taken place, but in other cases where when people talked about preemption, they were really talking about prevention. I think in retrospect, the Iraq war was probably a preventive war, not a preemptive one. Nonetheless, I think it's worth noting that, for example, at the 2004 Democratic nominating convention, when John Kerry gave his acceptance speech, he had a line in his speech which I quote in the postscript chapter to the paperback of my book, which is here, by the way. They make great bar mitzvah presents, wedding presents, and so on. I'll stay here as long as you want to sign them. John Kerry had a line, something like, I'm paraphrasing, but that America did not need a green light from abroad to use force if it had to defend its vital interests. And I mention it because the word preemption has become radioactive, but I think there's something much more profound and fundamental there. So, primacy, preemption, multilateralism. The Grand Strategy document is perhaps surprisingly multilateral. It has some very elevated language, which is also evocative of people like John Kennedy, that America can't do everything alone, but with our allies and friends, we can do far more things. But at the same time, it makes clear that multilateralism cannot be an excuse for doing nothing. I would paraphrase that aspect of Grand Strategy as much multilateralism as possible, as much unilateralism as necessary. The fourth and final point has to do with democratization. This is a much more controversial point, and it's striking that President Bush and his administration have taken a view about democratization which really harkens back to Woodrow Wilson in the immediate aftermath of World War I. The analysis about dictatorships fostering both repression and insecurity and instability, I think, is right. The problem is, how do you get from there to here? It's the transition which is so difficult. And here I would argue there was a need for much more finesse in understanding what democratization needs to be about. At the end of the day, the proper institutional framework is more important than elections. If you take a society which has been totally repressed, where moderate elements have been suppressed or jailed, the only refuge is in the mosques where conspiratorial groups operate, and you suddenly have elections without a decent rule of law, judicial system, all the other things we take for granted in established democracies, or even constitutional regimes that are not fully democratic, it's not surprising that the extremists win. I think a serious mistake took place in Iraq and in the Palestinian territories, in which the U.S. supported the holding of elections but did not require that those taking part in the elections disband their militias. Again, I can elaborate on this in the question period because I want to move to start to wrap up. Just a word in passing about alternative approaches to grand strategy. So-called realists argue that the U.S. is far too engaged abroad at too much cost, that America should disengage, be an offshore balancer, essentially retreat back home, and only intervene selectively when our most vital interests tend to be jeopardized. I think that's an effort at foreign policy on the cheap, and it's not likely to work. Because the longer first of all, withdrawal is more likely to foster disorder than stability. And second, if you find yourself forced ultimately to intervene late in the game, you almost always do so under much more dire and costly circumstances. Then, on the opposite side of the intellectual spectrum, and here I'm not talking about extreme views, but thoughtful people who, if they were standing up here, would handle the subject differently. Liberal internationalists, some of my best friends are liberal internationalists, some of my best friends are also realists, they're both wrong, but I respect their right to be wrong. Liberal internationalists, I think, tend to reify or embody the United Nations, the EU, as though these things were much more established, powerful, coherent, constitutional and sovereign vehicles than they actually are. And there, too, as with the realists trying to secure American foreign policy interests on the cheap at a discount rate, I think the same thing is true of liberal internationalists who say, well, we shouldn't use force, we shouldn't do anything except with all our allies together, only if it's supported by the United Nations. Well, only twice in the entire history of the United Nations has the UN authorized a significant war, nothing but lesser things, but a really major war, One was Korea in 1950, only because the Soviets walked out in anger over the ceding of Taiwan instead of communist China. And the second instance was with Iraq and Kuwait, only because it was just a ripe moment in history with the collapsing Soviet Union and very close relationships between the presidency of Bush 41 and Jim Baker and their Russian colleagues. That's it. In 1999, when the Clinton administration and NATO intervened to stop mass murder and ethnic cleansing in Kosovo, it was not with a United Nations mandate. The purists actually argued against it. They said it was illegal. Well, but NATO decided to do it and to stop mass murder. I think they were right to do it, but it suggests some of the limitations of the sort of purist liberal internationalist view. Let me wrap up. The third question is primacy, American primacy, necessary? Yes. Is it desirable? Yes. Is it sustainable? By the way, that's the topic of my next book. I don't know. Sustainability depends on both external and internal circumstances. Externally, we face what the Pentagon now calls, quote, a long war, unquote. A generation or more in length. The analogy of the Cold War is not a bad one, although, again, very different. We have tenacious adversaries driven by the kinds of things I've referred to. The adversaries include both non-state actors, but also states. They include asymmetric threats. And also we face an international environment where it's not always easy to cooperate with other countries for one reason or another, or international institutions. We also face a very dangerous vulnerability in terms of our energy, and especially oil imports, in ways that jeopardize our national security and our economy in the event of a future crisis. Our diplomacy has not always been so skillful as it should be. The old saying, I don't think I've used it yet, I did at our lunch table, that good diplomacy, as we say at Georgetown, is the art of telling somebody to go to hell in such a way that he looks forward to the trip. And I would submit that our diplomacy over the last half dozen years has not been so uniformly deft as it might have been. But domestically, there is a challenge which, if anything, may be greater. The great British strategist Michael Howard wrote a generation ago about what he calls the forgotten dimension of strategy, social cohesion and public support. That idea, by the way, goes back to the great Prussian strategist Karl von Clausewitz in the early part of the 19th century. The problem of social cohesion and public support is a very real one. No government in a democratic country can long sustain a foreign policy without at least a broad degree of public support. It doesn't have to be unanimous. It wasn't unanimous in World War II or the Cold War. But the degree of polarization and dissensus now suggests that it's hard to sustain the type of foreign policy that I think is a grand strategy that will be required. Well, let me conclude. The existential realities I've referred to, I think, are real, enduring, and are going to need to be in the forefront of those who think about and execute foreign policy in the coming decades. A new president will take office on January 20th, 2009. And whether that president's first name is Hillary or Condi or Rudy or some as yet unheralded Hollywood actor, I submit to you that that president is going to find a very strong logic in pursuing a grand strategy which looks something like what I've talked about with you here this afternoon. The one thing I can say for certain is they will not call it the Bush Doctrine. Thank you for listening.
Well, I think if you
Traditionally, we run the questioning, the Q&A in this group this way. We do it three questions at a time, none of which questions are preceded by editorial. We do it three questions at a time. We'll pick from the audience. So this gives the speaker an ability to address on a broad scale, and it saves time, and it allows more time for more questions. So right now, we'll entertain three questions. Jim?
Question. Thank you for that vigorous defense of hegemonic stability theory and of American primacy. My question, and I agree with your thesis, by the way, but
thank you. Let's take the next question.
Thucydides would have recognized the world that we live in today. So what is my question is, what is to say that we are not like the Athenians of the 21st century? Is there not going to be some major counterbalancing that may derail this great hegemonic stability that we are hoping for?
Next question. There.
It was reported this morning in the Dutch paper NRC Handelsblad that the Russian defense minister who is in line to become president after Putin has reported a multiplying of the defense budget over the next decade, and that he is also talking about adopting a strategy of asymmetrical military policy where they would aim cheap rockets at Europe instead of trying to build expensive rockets and aim them at the United States, because he said he knows they can't afford it. What do you think is going to be happening in that regard as far as Russia and or China in the country?
What's your policy
toward Iran? U.S. policy toward Iran? Oh, that's easy. Those are all terrific questions. I mean, I think it also suggests why we have just about a full house here today, given the subject matter, a subject matter that's not going to go away anytime soon. There are not simple answers to any of these questions. Just let me give you my immediate reactions. The long-term question about America and Athens and so on, it's not for, I mean, I like to never, as I tell my European friends, never bet against the United States. There are American society has a capacity for adaptation and rejuvenation, which is, I think, unique in the world. If you think of time and again in coping with economic reversals, societal problems, or dire international threats, and often after having made really awful mistakes, there's a capacity for renewal and adaptation which serves us in the long run. Most recently, about two decades ago, in the late 80s, there were a number of people, including Paul Kennedy, who got rich with books talking about American decline, at the time arguing that it was going to be Japan that was number one. And those proved short-sighted. Nonetheless, there are things that could make a difference. One of the big questions is what would happen if there were a series of mass casualty attacks in the United States, which proved so profoundly disruptive. That is a series of we talk about WMD or CBRN, but the things that are really most lethal would be either a nuclear device, radiological devices that poison a large area for decades, or some new engineered viral agent for which there was no known antidote, which disrupted things. There's that issue, which is unknowable. And how would America react after that? Would it begin to fall apart, or would it gather itself for international and domestic action of great ferocity? I'm more inclined to think the latter than the former. I hope none of this occurs, but there is that peril. And who can say, if you look back over the horrors of the last 100 years, two world wars, genocide, Pol Pot, all kinds of revolutions, upheavals, and so on. Anyone who could forecast the way our grandchildren are going to see the world over the next three quarters of a century has got better powers of vision than I do. The Russian case is fascinating. By the way, there are two main competitors for the next presidency after Putin, the defense minister and a guy who's a key economic figure. The implication is being that the latter is a more reasonable character than the former. Russia with its, I mean, Putin has re-strengthened power, has really crushed Russian democracy, made it a shell. So it's a democracy in name only. But Russia has a great vulnerability. Its population is imploding. The Russian population is falling by 750,000 people per year. Russia's economy is booming right now, but largely because of energy and raw material exports. We're here in the heart of the oil business, and we all know, it's a subject I've written on, the international politics of energy in the past, and oil and energy has had dramatic and often surprising booms and busts. Were there to be a bust in world oil, for whatever reason, the Russians are the most vulnerable country out there, second perhaps only to the Iranians in terms of their dependence on that. There's one more point. Some of you may have seen an article in Foreign Affairs about 6 months ago about American nuclear primacy, written by Daryl Press and Keir Lieber, which argues that the U.S. has acquired, whether intentionally or more or less inadvertently, nuclear primacy, that the U.S. is close to having a so-called first-strike nuclear capability against both the Soviet Russia and China, and that neither Russia nor China is likely to be able to redress that for some time to come. I don't think that it is in the interest of the Russians to pick a direct fight with the United States, but what they are trying to do is reassert their primacy and hegemony along their periphery, something that the Tsarist regimes did for several centuries before the Bolsheviks and Stalin and his successors. And I think that's probably more of what you have going on there. On Iran, my short answer is God only knows. There are aspects which are extremely dangerous. There are aspects which are moderately encouraging. The dangerous aspect is that Iran is a society with a very talented population, very good scientists and engineers, an enormous amount of energy wealth, and a leadership under Ahmadinejad that believes fanatical things and is involved with the most dangerous, first or second most dangerous terrorist organization in the world, which is Hezbollah. Iran is destabilizing all of its neighbors, its actions vis-a-vis Lebanon, Syria. Its actions in Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and the Palestinian territories are extremely dangerous. It has threatened its neighbors in the Gulf. And Ahmadinejad has expressed ideas which fit this pattern of sort of fanaticism and conspiracy theories. He doesn't accept the explanation for 9/11. He rejects the Holocaust. He has all kinds of other views, and at times he's even invoked the idea of the return of the hidden or 12th Imam, which is connected with a kind of apocalyptic view at the end of days in terms of Islam. On the other hand, there also is some evidence that the most pro-American Muslim population in the Middle East is the population of Iran. There was a notorious soccer game a few years ago at which at some point the crowd began chanting USA, USA. The reason they were doing that was their resentment against the mullahs. Ahmadinejad and his cronies suffered reverses in the last elections. If the Iranian political system were truly democratic, these guys would be out. But it isn't. Whether the balance of forces inside Iranian politics will shift remains to be seen. If it does, that would be a big help. If the Europeans, the Chinese, the Russians work with the U.S. at the United Nations and in the IAEA, we are capable of imposing painful enough sanctions that could create the mix of incentives and disincentives to stop the Iranian nuclear weapons program. But This is a potentially very dangerous situation. I don't expect that either Israel or the United States would take military action in the next couple of years, because I think they're still, the Iranians are still a couple of years away from this. But the risks there are very considerable, and there is no short, easy answer about what our policy to Iran should be.
Three more questions, Mark.
What are your concerns about Chavez and Venezuela?
Next question.
You've described the situation with Russia. Doesn't China pose a similar picture?
Third question.
The Ottoman Empire being the demarcation point, is there the recognition that, whether right or wrong, some of the actions that have occurred subsequent to that have added or possibly added fuel to the fire? And also, along the same lines, you mentioned the importance of the public being informed. What do you have any thoughts or concerning thoughts on how to inform an American public who isn't even aware that their own domestic issues, much less?
Again, excellent questions. On Chavez and Venezuela, I'm going to take a pass. I know a lot of things, but I was once the senior coordinator for Middle East issues in the 1988 Dukakis for President campaign. And Dukakis's problem was he was so smart he didn't know what he didn't know. And you couldn't tell him. I don't know. I think there are a lot of people in this room who probably know the Chavez-Venezuela situation a lot better than I do. What I know about Chavez, I don't like one bit. But I don't think I can really contribute anything useful on that subject. So I'll pass with respect. On the question about China, absolutely. If there is any country in the world that has the capacity to counterbalance the United States, it is China. I think for the moment, for the foreseeable future, the overriding priority of the Chinese leadership is to develop China economically, because of the massive problem of absorbing population off the land and the fact that their economic fate rests on a stable international trading and investment environment. They do not want to rock the boat. This is short to medium term. I think over the long term, it remains to be seen whether a surging, huge, populous, increasingly rich China will be take on the responsibilities and role in the international system that it ought to, or will become a disruptive player who ultimately overturns that system. The analogy would be with the role of Imperial Germany around the turn of the century over 100 years ago. Dynamic, powerful, growing, accomplished, and ultimately a society that precipitated both World War I and World War II. It's not foreordained either way. There are risks. Something like the Taiwan problem could get out of hand. And it's even the case that there's an important struggle going on in China now between the present president, Hu Jintao, and Jiang Zemin and his cronies. It's possible that anti-satellite business the other day may have been done without Hu Jintao's knowledge or involvement, or even against his wishes. We just don't know. But China is really the huge question mark, and the one country in the world that could be a real challenger to the United States. On the Western responsibility for the collapse of the Ottoman Empire and the upheavals and problems of the Middle East, I'm from Chicago, and I'm not into guilt. I'm just not wired that way. You'll have to forgive me. In what passes for discourse in Middle East studies and postmodernism, the West and America are battered around the head and shoulders for colonialism and neocolonialism and oppression and racism and so on. I'm sorry, I don't buy it. The worst oppressors of Arabs and Muslims are other Arabs and Muslims. Moreover, to the extent there was colonial guilt in the Middle East, the Turks themselves were colonial. They're not Arabs, they're Muslims. It was Turkish imperialism, Ottoman imperialism, that dominated the region. And the main European colonial powers were the ones who were responsible for drawing the borders. It was Sykes-Picot and the Brits and French and so on. So as I say, I'm not big into guilt, and I don't think that's really takes you very far, except if you want to write a postmodernist thesis in post-colonial studies or Middle Eastern studies in academia these days. I'm a political scientist and international relations specialist, so I'm mercifully not involved in it. On the last part of the question about information, I agree that's a matter of great concern. The fact that America's great national and regional newspapers are downsizing their foreign bureaus is bad. And let me connect it to another thing. I think one of the worst failings, a bipartisan failing, in the late 90s was the destruction of the U.S. Information Agency. During the Cold War, the Fulbright program, American libraries, trips overseas by American speakers, concert groups, jazz groups, artists, political figures, bringing foreigners here, the American centers, were all a long-term investment kind of that grew and grew and grew in many important ways. People exposed to those programs a generation later, including even one figure in the Soviet leadership, proved to be pivotal figures whose experience was fundamentally shaped by these things. In the mid to late 90s, the Jesse Helms, Republican chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and the Clinton administration did away with the U.S. Information Agency. Well, we live in a world of a global village, and CNN and the Internet. We don't need this anymore. And they did away with it. It was melded into the State Department, where it's virtually disappeared. I think that is tragic. It's tragic, in effect, I twisted the question, because I'm talking about foreigners' knowledge of the United States, but I think also that the satellite TV, cable TV, the Internet, which often precipitate the flow of unmediated information, so wild rumors and stories flow at the without any quality control at the speed of light, gives the illusion of real knowledge about the outside world, but not the substance, which is why I think having quality newspapers, quality television, quality magazines, quality outfits like the World Affairs Council is crucial. You need the informed, educated public needs to be knowledgeable. These things are not open and shut, and it's of major consequence, not least because these issues are going to affect all of our lives and those of our children and grandchildren.
We have time for two more questions, after which while we formally adjourn, yet we then traditionally everybody gathers around the podium who wish to talk personally with him, also to sign his book. Two more questions.
Wanted to know what you think about how much of our foreign policy is driven by or shaped around our military industrial complex.
Second question.
What is the promise of coalitions of the willing?
And there was a question here about the dollar.
What is the future of the U.S. dollar?
Boy, if I knew the answer to the future of the U.S. dollar, I'd be out there speculating and so on, running a big hedge fund and so on. And there may be people in financial services who can answer that better than I can. I do think, though, that because the Chinese and the Asians need to, because export markets are so important and competitiveness is so important, that they do not want to dump dollars. A few years ago, you would have been surprised that the dollar is as strong as it is today. I have a hunch that the dollar is not in dire shape. As a share of GDP, the domestic budget deficit is actually fairly modest today. The balance of trade and payments deficit is another story, however, and whether that's going to be sustainable is anybody's guess. If it does not turn around, then the dollar could be threatened. Which is why foreign investments have often been a useful place to park some of your capital. But beyond that, I wouldn't even guess what the course of the dollar will be over the next year or two, let alone long term. Although, again, based on what I said before, it's always a mistake to bet against the United States. It's a society that's so large, so dynamic, so vigorous, so capable of self-correction that I think it would be a mistake to adopt one of the more pessimistic or doomsday scenarios about the dollar long term. On the foreign policy and military industrial complex. On the one hand, on the other hand. On the one hand, every war that the U.S. has ever been involved in has involved a certain degree of corruption, malfeasance, mismanagement, waste, fraud, and abuse. Alas. In the American Civil War, for instance, if you know those histories, any large organization is almost inevitably going to see that. Power corrupts, and so on and so forth. Having said that, I think it's a mistake to assume, as some of our foreign brothers and sisters do, that you can explain America through the military-industrial complex. I just don't buy it. The society is too large and diverse. The differences among leaders and parties, particular decisions, whether or not to go to war in Iraq, for instance, cannot be understood through that lens. I'd also note that while those who complain about the high level of defense spending, at the time of 9/11, the share of U.S. gross domestic product going for defense was 2.9%. That was the lowest share of GDP for defense since Pearl Harbor. During the Cold War, we were typically spending into the double digits in the 50s and 60s, 10, 12, 13% of GDP on defense. At the height of the Reagan buildup in the mid-80s, the U.S. spent 6.6% of GDP on defense. As of today, the number is very roughly in the neighborhood of 4.5% of GDP. So the U.S. can afford what it needs to spend both to build up the armed forces in size, regardless of what happens in Iraq, which I think there's bipartisan agreement about, as well as to maintain the kind of defense we need. The tougher questions are, one, what choices do you make within that defense establishment between big systems and personnel and high tech and so forth? Those are more technical but still important tactical decisions and force composition decisions. But the other part is, do you follow a domestic monetary and fiscal policy that provides the kind of stable economic basis to sustain the serious burdens of having to spend what we need to spend on defense? And that has to do with political choices made by our political parties and the Congress and the administration. Lastly, about coalitions of the willing, ideally you would have what happened in Desert Storm, where for only the second time in history, the United Nations Security Council, in effect, authorized the use of force to countries where, when Resolution 678 passed in late 1990, the UN member countries under Chapter 7 in the UN Charter were authorized to use, quote, all necessary means, unquote, to get Iraq out of Kuwait if the Iraqis didn't comply by January 15, 1991. And that was a war led by the United States, not fought under a UN flag, but with a UN mandate and with several dozen countries taking part. That would be ideal. But rarely do the stars line up that way. So then you have, say, the Kosovo War, where the U.S. led the NATO countries in an air war to halt massive Serb killings and ethnic cleansing of Kosovo Muslims. Then you have Iraq, again, whether you think it was a good idea or a bad idea, where the U.S. did go into Iraq with the support of some other countries. What's interesting about Iraq is that at the time of the war began, about 70% of the American public, about three-quarters of the members of the U.S. Senate, and about two-thirds of the member governments of NATO and the European Union gave at least lip service or rhetorical or psychological or political support to the use of force against Saddam. But as John F. Kennedy once said, success has 1,000 fathers and defeat is an orphan. So I don't have an immediate answer to the question about coalitions of the willing, except to say that the more the better. In retrospect, we might have been better off if the administration had bent over backward to draw more countries and NATO into the start of the war in Afghanistan, although there was understandable concern not to get so convoluted that it handicapped us, which was a problem in Kosovo. But this is going to be a long-term question of great importance for the future. Thank you very much for listening. Be glad to stay around for questions.
For more information about the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth, visit them on the web at
dfwworld.org.